In this episode, my guest and I talk about the roles of food allergy consultants, counselors, and advocates, sharing tips for those wanting to move into these roles. You'll walk away from this episode with guidance on how to become an allergy advocate without burning yourself out, what experiences are helpful to become a food allergy consultant, and what training is required to work as an allergy-informed therapist. And we share insights into our own transitions into these roles.
Welcome to Exploring Food Allergy Families, a podcast with real talk, relatable conversations, and practical tips focused on navigating the impacts that food allergies have on families, relationships, and mental health. I'm Tamara Hubbard, licensed therapist and the host of Exploring Food Allergy Families. Please remember that while this podcast offers general advice, it should never replace medical or mental health care guidance from your own healthcare team.
Joining me today for our discussion on becoming a food allergy advocate or professional is Gina Mennett-Lee. Gina is a food allergy consultant and educator and has worked for over a decade within the food allergy community. Using her education and experience as a former teacher and trained school administrator, she specializes in food allergy management in the school setting. She holds a master's degree in educational leadership and bachelor's degrees in both elementary and special education. She is a parent to a child with food allergies, as well as the co-author of the Preschool Food Allergy Handbook. If you'd like to connect with her on social media, she can be reached or followed at Food Allergy Consulting on Instagram and on Twitter at Mennett-Lee LLC. Thanks so much for joining me today, Gina.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I think listeners will get a whole new perspective on what it means to be an advocate or professional within the food allergy community with our discussion today, for sure.
Yeah, I'm hoping to shed some light on that.
Yeah, it's a big topic. And, you know, the word food allergy advocate, we hear that a lot. You know, I think anyone can be an advocate or can advocate. And then, of course, there's food allergy professions that are growing by the leaps and bounds here. I know like food allergy counseling is becoming a growing niche, and you're a food allergy consultant and have been. So I think that's another growing area too. Would you tell me a little bit about your work as a food allergy consultant and an advocate and what you've helped your clients and community with over the years?
Sure. I mean, I think like many of us that are in the food allergy, you know, sphere, I came into it because I was personally impacted by it.
Yeah.
My daughter has a food allergy and had a really like near fatal reaction when she was about 2.5. Oh, and I was a teacher. So coming out of that, I realized that, wow, if this reaction had taken place in my classroom, even with my knowledge of how to respond, that the outcome would have not been the positive outcome that we had.
Yeah.
Because I knew that the schools were just not in a position to handle that at that point.
And so this was years ago too, right? I mean, things have changed over the years.
She's 16. So, you know, so that was like 14 years ago.
Yeah. Things were different.
So at that point I knew I had to do something because I knew she would be entering school in a few years and that they were just not ready. They had EpiPens in the nurse's room locked. People were not trained. I knew there was a lot that needed to be done. So I initially went down the road of becoming like starting a support group and then working with a group of parents in my school district to get changes done in that school district. And we did. So that was the advocate hat. And then I started a nonprofit to work on the education portion of it, educating the community, providing support groups for children and for parents. And then from there, I realized that, wow, really more needs to be done. School districts need the education and training, and parents need help navigating the school system. And since I had that unique background of being a parent to a child with food allergy, but also having like 3 education degrees and having written 504 plans and been held responsible for that
Yeah.
On the flip side, on the school side of it, I knew that I could bring experienced perspective that would help people. And that was kind of where the consultant came in. Okay. The other labels didn't ever really fit me, like coach. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That just didn't fit what I was doing. I was bringing specialized training that would help with a specific purpose in a specific scenario.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's all these C words, coach, consultant, counselor. And even within our own fields, it can be kind of confusing as to who does what and when someone should reach out to somebody. And then, of course, to the general public, that's confusing as well. Right. But I love that you knew your role specifically. You knew how you wanted to impact this community, yours and the broader community. And you sort of knew what you wanted to do. You know, you knew you wanted to be a consultant. Somebody had a problem or needed some information that you were then able to help them problem solve and guide them on.
Right. Exactly. And I also knew like what I know and what I don't know. And I'm always very clear about that. Like what I do is specific. It's specific to schools and it could be working with principals, it could be working with teachers, mm-hmm. or it could be working with parents, but it's all those different stakeholders in the school system that I can help because I've seen all sides of that. I've been all of those things. So I'm able to deal with that and deal with the communication between all of those stakeholders.
But I love that you also did advocacy work on a broader scale. And it's funny because I wrote a piece on my blog probably, I don't know, a couple of years ago now about evolving into an advocate. And you kind of hit the nail on the head when you were talking about your journey into this space, that we tend to start with, you know, our own, a lot of us, myself included, are usually parents of or somebody managing an allergy ourselves. And so we start with what we know in our inner system, right? Our family system, our own system, and then we branch out to maybe our community system. And then after that, you know, some of us are called to or pulled into wanting to help the broader system, the community, you know, nationwide or internationally, and then start to move into that. And that sounds like the trajectory you took too.
Yeah, I mean, I love the way that you've stated that. I think it's an easy way to try to understand that. Mm-hmm. And so there were different tipping points where I was like, okay, this, I need to move to this different area. And so I do think, you know, the last area or the most current area is that broader area. Because I feel like I have, you know, a limited amount of time. And so the time that I do spend, I want to be spending on making as big an impact as I can and making sure that I'm using the tools that I have or the education experience I have to make as big an impact as I can.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's actually jump into like segue right into, some tips or guidance we might give those in the community that want to either become advocates or some kind of allergy professional. And we'll circle back to the allergy professionals after this too, because I want to talk a little bit more about that. But let's kind of give some tips that we've learned over the years, because I've been in the allergy community in one of these roles or more for about a decade now. So, you know, we've both sort of been in this space for a while, and we've seen a lot of things. And so I think we could offer some really good tips and insight into those that want to advocate and what does advocacy mean? And, you know, you kind of talked with what you just said about this balance of, I only have so much time, but I want to work on something that's meaningful for me and is going to make an impact. And that's a choice you made.
Yeah, I've had this discussion with many people because I think sometimes too, there's pressure.
Yeah.
Pressure to be available to people all the time, pressure to sometimes even advocate on the school level. And I always start with saying you have to like take care of your family first.
Yeah.
And if what you're doing right now, which may be being a room parent, is helping your child, and that's really your bandwidth and all you can deal with right now, then you've got to let go of the other things.
Yeah.
I know sometimes they feel pressure. We need to make this change, or I need to advocate here, but they're so over stressed or, you know, overwhelmed with everything. And I'm like, if what you're doing is fine. And when you're ready or when you do have time, you can move on and knock off some of these other goals that you may have. So I think it has to be right for you, right for your family. And I think you have to be selfish in a way. Like you have to really pay attention to what's drawing your time and make sure that it's in alignment with what it is that you prioritize, because it's easy to get pulled into lots of different directions.
You're spot on. And I know you and I talked before this episode, and we both sort of were speaking the same language about this values-based decision-making. And I think that's basically what you're speaking about is, it is so easy to get caught up and continue to want to advocate and then move up and advocate on a broader scale. And it's admirable. And many of us choose to do that because it's something we want to do. But it has to work for your, like you said, your family. It has to work for your life. And it doesn't have, it shouldn't be an obligation. It should be something that, you know, what I talk with my clients a lot about, even outside of the food allergy space, is just this idea of prioritizing what's important in life. And if we start to prioritize things that are letting us, you know, make decisions that are not fulfilling other priorities. So, you know, for example, I'll give you an example. I was a mom blogger. I hate that term, but that's what we called ourselves back in like 2009 when that first started, right? Yeah. Scary Mommy was just starting. And I got into that as a therapeutic way of processing going from parent of one child to two, which I struggled with. And so I was getting involved in that. And then all of a sudden you get caught up in it. And it feels good because, you know, you're getting caught up in making a difference. It's the same thing in the food allergy advocacy space. You know, you're making a difference. It feels good. You're helping. But next thing I knew, a couple years into it, my husband was like, I never see you anymore. You're always at your computer. You know, my kids were little at the time. So I had to make a choice to step away from that because it, because what I felt good about doing, which was wonderful and helpful, was taking away my focus on other things that are also equally important to me.
Right. I mean, yeah. And I know we discussed this earlier off of this podcast, but I pulled back significantly from the work that I was doing on Facebook, on Instagram, on my website and blogging, because of the same things. I, at one point just said, okay, listen, what is the most important thing to me? Yeah. And as my children are growing, the most important thing to me is to be with them and to not miss things. And even though I was, you know, getting paid well to go and, you know, do some education or training in other parts of the country, I was missing, you know, a practice or a game. And like, I don't want to miss a field hockey game. That might not be someone else's priority, but for me, I want to be there and watch that. That's more important to me than being, you know, at in another place, giving a speech or doing some training, and I'm now missing out on something, you know, with my family. And it's such a short window that for me, that's where my priorities are.
Yeah.
And so I pulled back from that.
So I definitely think some of the top tips for those that are considering becoming an advocate or expanding their advocacy beyond their family and their own community, perhaps, is, like you said, setting your priorities, recognizing when those priorities have shifted and you need to shift your approach or your time or your commitment to something, and then making decisions based on what's valuable and important in your own life. And that's going to look different for everybody. Some people will be better at balancing that all and not feeling like they're not giving other important things their time and energy and be able to be available to everybody all the time. Others will not be able to. And we shouldn't feel bad about that. If we don't pay attention to those things, that can lead to burnout.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And I at different points, I definitely have felt burnt out. And I think anybody that's in this sphere, you know, will go through that. I think those are awesome tips. I would add that just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should or have an obligation to do it. That was something that was really tough for me.
Yeah.
I would see often conversations on Facebook where people were giving advice about like let's say 504 planning, and it was not advice that would be helpful, but I realized at some point that I cannot physically go through every single post and set people straight with the correct information. Like I just cannot do that.
Yeah.
So I had to learn to, you know, let go of that and not feel an obligation to do that.
That can be hard. And I think that leads to another point that, you know, we talked about bringing up too, is that, you know, it takes a village in any community, especially those of, you know, chronic conditions like this. We have to be able to acknowledge others in the community that have different skill sets. It's okay for us to divide and conquer. It's okay for us to collaborate. It's okay for us to say, hey, you know, I could probably give you some tips on that, but I'm not available. And actually, I think this other person over here might have a better understanding of that.
And I also think it's, you know, I think that we in the food allergy community need to acknowledge and appreciate the skills that people bring to the table and to compensate people for that. Because if they are putting in a significant amount of time and they do have a good knowledge base, then you should be willing to pay them for that, or else they're going to leave that sphere because it's not going to be worth it to them. So I think that's another thing too. I think you need to, we need to be lifting people up and supporting businesses and supporting people that have those skill sets that are needed in the food allergy community.
I agree. Yeah. And because again, that can lead to to burnout for the advocates or the people who are involved in helping in this community. Because you're right. It they're not that everyone needs to be paid for their time and efforts, but if they're, you know, significantly contributing and it's making an impact, even just recognizing, not even monetarily, sometimes just recognizing them and thanking them and you know, being gracious and appreciative of their time and effort and help.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. And, you know, the other thing I'll say about advocacy before we switch gears to sort of the more allergy professional focus is, you know, in that blog post that I wrote, it sort of took through phases of advocacy too. And, you know, you'll recognize those that have been in the advocacy space or been involved in food allergies for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, and their kids are getting older and sort of moving on with independence, you'll start to see sort of a shift in some of these advocates kind of backing out. Maybe it's not because of burnout or they need to put their time somewhere else. It's just their shift on what they want to focus on has finally changed. And now they're maybe doing something more for themselves or, you know, deciding to take a role in a different community. And so then that actually gives space for other advocates to come up who are sort of newer to this community. And I think it's important that we, you know, we want to recognize some of the new advocates that are moving into the space as well as those that have been around for a long time too.
Absolutely. I think you need a mix of both. I think the people that have been around the block a while can give valuable advice and help guide the process and maybe help others escape pitfalls that they may have gone into. And then the new people that come in, they're bringing in a lot of passion and kind of reminding people that have been there for a while of like those stages and what still needs to be done to help, you know, children and families, you know, through those different stages.
Yeah. And things change over the years, as we've seen, right? And so they may have more knowledge about what's currently happening, like in schools or activities and things like that too.
Definitely.
I think it's the same in any field. I mean, I'm thinking about like teachers too. I've heard, you know, these new teachers coming in and they're so passionate and, you know, same with therapists too. So it just makes sense in this sphere too. Let's switch a little bit to discuss sort of our roles as professionals. You know, you as a consultant, myself as an allergy-informed therapist, what kinds of questions do you get about being a consultant? Do you have people who will reach out and say, hey, you know, I'm an advocate, but I want to be a consultant. What do you do? How did you decide to do it? What do I need to do for training? And then I can share a little bit about the questions I get too.
Yeah. I mean, I think I get that question a lot. Yeah. I often get that question from people that did not come from an education background. And so I have a little bit of difficulty with that because the reason why I became a food allergy consultant in the school sphere is because, you know, I was a special education teacher. I was a regular education teacher. I taught middle school. I taught elementary school. I did an internship to be a principal. I have my degree to be in a principal. So I have all those.
That's a lot.
Experiences that I'm drawing from real life experience so that when I go into a meeting or when I'm asked to do a training, I'm talking teacher to teacher or I'm talking administrator to administrator. That's what I bring to the table. So as if a someone that's a parent that's navigated the school system wants to become a consultant and help other parents navigate the school system, I can't really tell them that path because that's the path that I took.
I
would just, you know, have the caveat that when you're speaking to people, just be very clear with what skills and knowledge and experience you are bringing to the table.
That's a good tip.
If you are a parent and you maybe weren't a teacher, don't have an education background, you know, I think it's important to just, you know, state that I can help you navigate this based on, you know, the 504 meetings that I did with my child, but that's the experience that I'm bringing.
I think that's a very good caveat. I mean, no matter what field we're in, or even as an advocate, just saying, you know, I'm sharing this information based on, like you said, my own personal experience and what I learned from it, or I'm sharing this based on my training or whatever it is that you're sharing, kind of qualify that with here's why I'm sharing that.
Right. And it's a very serious thing as well. I mean, we're talking about a life-threatening illness. And when I work with clients, whether it's a school district or a parent, I have contracts and I had to have drawn up by lawyers that specifically lay out, you know, what my expertise is and what it is not. When I've done expert witness, I've been expert witness in court cases. That same with that, you know, I'm very specific about saying I am not a doctor. I am not a lawyer. This is what I'm bringing to the table. And you have to realize that what you say and do has consequences. And you have to be very thoughtful about what you're saying and doing and making sure that you're not overstepping your expertise.
That's so important. And I totally echo that because, you know, even as a therapist, I know what I should be doing and what I'm trained to do and where my boundaries are. And I think it's the onus is on the professional, whether you're a consultant, a coach, or a therapist, or a psychologist, or a doctor, or a lawyer, you need to know your boundaries because we can't expect the community or our clients or our patients to know those boundaries. We have to be able to clearly communicate that to whomever we're talking to, because if we don't do that, our clients and our patients are going to assume that we can do things we're not trained to do. And that's a tough place. Once you get into that space, it can be hard to say, oh gosh, that's outside of my boundaries. It's important that we do that for the safety of not only our patients, but ourselves. But yeah, I think you bring up a really good point about that.
I mean, I'm referring a lot because I do field a lot of questions. I know I had just referred someone to you even last week because someone had reached out to me and said that their child was, you know, dealing with a lot of anxiety and they were really concerned about it. And yes, you know, I have experienced anxiety. You know, my child does deal with anxiety, but that doesn't make me a trained professional.
Yeah.
I could definitely listen to someone and I can, you know, say what worked for me or worked for my child, but I am not a therapist. And so my immediate response was, you know, I'm really sorry that you're dealing with this. But here are some resources that I can recommend. Here's some websites and here's like a person that I recommend you reach out to that has those skills that you need. And so I feel like it's that. And also I get a lot of law questions. And although for my degrees, I had to study law and I had law courses, I'm not a lawyer. Something that it has to deal with that, I'm very quick to refer them to a lawyer that's trained to deal with that.
Yeah. Well, and I want to segue in a second to what segment that I'm going to call, who are you going to call? I'm like channeling Ghostbusters. All of my references are 80s and 90s. Like everyone can tell I grew up in every episode.
The 90s are back in right now. So
I heard.
You're hip again.
I think one of the last ones I just recorded, I referred to Inspector Gadget. And I'm thinking, God, there's going to be a lot of people who have no idea who that is. And did you hear that the American Girl doll in the last 6 to 12 months, the historic doll is the 80s doll? That's the historic doll. I was like offended by that. I was like, oh my God, I know total segue here, but I'm sure those listening will identify with that.
That would make me really old.
Right. I just,
I can't be old.
No, it felt icky inside. I don't know. Anyhow, no offense to the American Girl dolls. I think they're great. And they have a, you know, a kit for allergy care too. But I just was sort of like, wow, are we there yet? I guess so. Anyhow, the questions that I typically get as an allergy informed therapist is, first I'll get, that's a thing. And I go, yes, it's a newer niche. You know, if you think about diabetes or other medical conditions, they're kind of ahead of us as far as research mm-hmm. and sort of time that they've been focused on. And so this is an evolving space. And I think in 5 years, this food allergy counseling niche will look different than it does today. And so one of my roles is I like to push that forward. That's my goal, right? And so I'll also get, well, what kind of training do you need? And of course, like you, my background, I've been a clinical therapist for 16 years. So, and I'm family therapy trained. I have my master's in marriage and family therapy. So I bring all of that together, and I'm an allergy mom whose child has been through treatments and trials. So I have that experience as well. But I'm, you know, my advice to anyone who wants to be a food allergy or an allergy informed therapist is that you've got to get your graduate degree in counseling or psychology or social work or marriage family therapy, one of those degrees.
Yeah.
And then at this point in time, there's no specific training for allergy work. That is probably going to change in the next year or two. I talk with a lot of others in this space, other psychologists at the medical institutions, and all of us are sort of working with our advocacy our professional organizations on a national level to sort of bring this to the forefront. So I do think there will be more training for those that want to work in this space as therapists, but right now it's bringing your clinical work and then having a really good understanding of food allergies, IgE mediated food allergies. I get a lot of emails from people, and I don't know if you get emails like this too, where they'll say, you know, I do a lot of work with autoimmune, which is equally as important, or, you know, IgG mediated and, you know, can I be listed in your directory? And, you know, their work is wonderful, but there's something specific. I want these therapists to have to know about IgE mediated that are life threatening, because there's a different level of anxiety and experiences that we're going to go through.
Yeah. And also, you know, different strategies for managing it.
Yep. Absolutely.
So kind of a different beast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there have been some therapists who aren't very aware of allergies, and they'll tell parents or kids, you know, don't be so worried. That's not going to help in this situation. We have to acknowledge the worry. And of course, there's going to be worry, but what do we do with it? So that's for another episode. Anyhow, let's segue into who you're going to call. And I'll throw out a couple of scenarios, you know, quick scenarios of if this is something you're needing information on, or it might help somebody who's thinking about wanting to become an allergy advocate or professional, sort of know sort of what space they need to be in. So if you're somebody who needs to learn how to read a label, who would you say they should reach out to?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of people like food allergy coaches, food allergy consultants, parents that have like walked that walk that could really help you out there. Mm-hmm. But I'd also add that I'm a person that likes to go directly to the source.
Yeah.
So I would go to the label reading laws. And I also designed that label reading guide. I don't know if you're aware of it.
That's fascinating.
The FDA actually uses it to train. There.
Wow. Yeah.
So that is like a one sheet guide for how to read a label.
Yeah.
I have to update it now for Sesame, which is amazing. I'm so happy about that. But I think, you know, reaching out to those people that you fit in the food allergy community that have been there before that could help you with understanding the laws, understanding what labels do tell you and what they do not tell you, because I think that almost is sometimes more important. And then also, like I said, I like going to the actual sources, reading for myself, knowing exactly what the laws are. Honestly, when I have friends who have children with food allergies, and they're different allergies than my daughter has, and even with everything that I know, I always give the label to them and I say, here you go, you read it, because I don't trust that I'm going to be able to pick up on everything that they're reading for.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. It's a really good point. Okay, so if we're talking about diagnosis and treatment of allergies or reactions, this one might seem obvious, but who should people turn to?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I just feel like we should be turning to our allergists and or any other people that might be in the field. I know there are some great nurses who specialize in the mm-hmm. allergy field, but definitely someone that's medically trained.
Yeah. Okay. What about needing help with 504 planning?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's one of the things that I, you know, I feel as a consultant, you know, a very, you know, well equipped to deal with because mm-hmm. I had to write 504 plans for other children. I had to do testing. I had to work through all of that. And I had to take, you know, courses and learn about the law and everything with that. So I feel like someone that has the educational training around 504 plans works. So yeah. Someone has that kind of background, a lawyer, but a lawyer that works within the school system.
Yeah.
Because sometimes there are people that practice law that really aren't working in that sphere and they may not know how to navigate some of the tricky spots, but definitely like a lawyer that works in with education.
Okay. What about, okay, this one's obvious. Intense anxiety that impacts daily life. That's going to be a licensed therapist or psychologist.
Yeah. And everything comes back to the Facebook groups or different groups. You can get great information.
Absolutely.
And they can be a source of support with the 504 plans, with the reading the label, with all these things. But you, mm-hmm. but if you're really struggling with something and you need that advice, you really have to go to people that are trained.
Yeah.
Because it can set you back. I know at least with the 504 planning, if you're getting the wrong advice, you can really set things back a lot. Mm-hmm. And I would think the same would be with the therapy. If yeah. you're going down the wrong road, you can really set your, I don't know what you would call, but maybe recovery or your management of it back.
Yeah. I mean, it can impact your mindset, your ability to cope, your ability to navigate, you know, stress and distress. No, I agree. I have seen some good advice given out through the support groups and the Facebook groups and social media. You know, the way that I give advice on when to turn to those versus a professional is, you know, just again, kind of back to previous part of our conversation, be aware of what information you're going to get from each sphere. And so the support groups and the online Facebook groups and social media are going to give you more anecdotal support or information, which has a value. Yes. You know, it can make you feel validated and not alone. It can give you great ideas that you hadn't thought about. Mm-hmm. However, in certain situations, moments, or when things get more intense and harder to manage, that's when you want to turn to the person who's specifically trained in that area.
Right. And I think there are some really great groups that are managed by regulators that are really good at delineating, you know, the limitations of the groups. And so that I seek out those groups.
Yeah,
that,
me too.
This is what we're discussing. This is what we're not discussing. This is when you're going off track. I think it's really important to have those.
I 100% agree. And I think as we're sort of wrapping up here, I think, you know, that kind of connects to the takeaway for everything we've said here. If you're somebody who wants to become an advocate sort of on a more broader scale outside of just your family and your community, or who wants to become an allergy professional in a variety of different ways, you know, being a consultant, a therapist, or you're training to be an allergist, it's important to know what your goals are, what your boundaries are, what your scope of practice is, or what you are able to help somebody with, and know who to turn to when you can't.
Yeah, I agree with all of that.
Yeah. And again, if you'd like to become an advocate, just being mindful of your time and your energy. And it's wonderful to help people. I think many of us get into these roles or become advocates because we do. We want to make change and we want to help others. But, you know, it's important that you are putting your priorities in your own life offline first as well. And, you know, don't set yourself up for burnout because then you can't be helpful to yourself or anyone else.
Yeah, definitely. And it's like with everything, it's okay to say no.
Absolutely.
First.
No is a complete sentence.
Yeah.
No is
needed. It's just my answer.
It's okay to say no. I can't do that right now, but you know, here's who I can connect you with, right? So
right.
It's okay to say no. Yes, I practice that myself. Okay, so before we end, I always ask my guests a final question. And season 2's final question is, one way people can build confidence in living with a food allergy is by doing what?
I think I can just say what was helped me. And for me, it was taking control of the diagnosis by doing my own research, not reading filtered information or someone else's perspective on the information, but going directly to the source and taking control of that information.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Gina, for coming and joining me today so that we could chat about allergy advocates and professionals and the value they bring to the allergy community. And I hope it gives listeners some good points to think about, especially if they're wanting to move into these roles.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And thank you all for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes and share this podcast with others who might enjoy it too. Until we connect for the next episode, be good to yourselves and take care.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode of Exploring Food Allergy Families. Be sure to subscribe via your favorite podcast app so that you don't miss future ones. And if you're looking for an allergy-informed behavioral healthcare provider or for additional resources on any of the topics discussed in these podcasts, visit the Food Allergy Counselor directory and website at www.foodallergycounselor.com.